Today is May 10th, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive and Oral History Project, today I'm interviewing Bryce Durbin over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games. Bryce, can you begin with when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Missouri, but actually grew up in Kansas, I guess shortly after I was born, and went to school, grade school in Kansas most of the time. It's like Burns, B-U-R-N-S, Kansas, and that's not too far out of Wichita, but it's a little town of about 450 people, and I attended there. And my father was a superintendent and also a coach in a small school there, but that's where I started out, and then I can go quickly where I went after that as to my involvement with athletics, which ended up being my life. So if I could tell you a little, if it makes any difference, why, I can tell you.
Yeah, that would be great. Go ahead.
Okay. All right, it was a small school, and of course, I learned to play basketball there, and my junior year, why the Army was drafting anybody that was 18 years old. And my father being superintendent, he said that my grades being where they were, I could skip my senior year and go start to college, which I did. And I started, basketball is my sport, and I participated in other things, football and track, but right at the end of my junior year, why, Fog Allen was a coach at KU, one of the greatest coaches, and I was going to go to Wichita to play basketball, and I started at Lawrence and was able to attend a semester there, but work out 3 weeks with Mr. Allen, and that gave me a lot of starts, and went to Wichita University, and quickly tell you that I was there two full years before the Army drafted me at 18. Because that started at 16, and was able, when I was drafted, while the world was still going, and then it all of a sudden stopped, and found that if you're in the Army for a year, why, they'd be dismissed, which I was able to do, and I started, the reason I didn't go overseas after my basic training, my dad had said, get typing and shorthand, and then might keep you that way. So sure enough, after my basic training in football, in Army, why, they wanted me to come into the headquarters right there and be able to type and shorthand, which then gave me a good start. And in my first year, I was able to get out and start to college, and I went to college to finish out my 2 years of because I'd played basketball at Wichita University for 2 years, and went to Warrensburg, Missouri, and I didn't plan to play anymore, but I got my degree quickly, and at the end, to round it off, at the end of my, I was just 21, I got my master's degree from University of Missouri, and then that's when I was hired as my first coaching at Marysville, Kansas, and I coached there 2 years, and then went to Arkansas City, a much larger school, after 2 years there, 3 years as a coach, basketball coach, then to Hutchinson, one of the bigger schools. And it was there 2 years, and then Ralph Miller at Wichita University hired me as his assistant at Wichita U, which I went there. And after the first year, a fellow in the State High School Association, in charge of all athletics and music and so forth in Kansas, he wanted me to come in there because I'd had good background in music and so forth. So I actually was hired by the State High School Association and started there in 1957. And I was there until 1977 when I was hired in Kansas. Here I was in charge of athletics, music, speech, and so forth, and for the state. And then after, in 1977, I was hired as a executive director of the National High School Federation organization, which was over every state and so forth for music, speech, and athletics. And, of course, the involvement in the Olympics, which I, once I got in the National Federation office, actually before that, I'm sorry, while I was still in Kansas, why I had some track background, and the Olympic Committee asked me to be serve on their committee on a state on the National Federation meeting, and then in 1968 for the Olympics in Mexico City, why I was on the United States Olympic Board, why they wanted me to be there as one of the managers of the track team, men's track team. And, of course, that excited me. And our training went to Tahoe, T-A-H-O-E, in Mexico City because the altitude was the same, about the same as it would be down in Mexico City. And so that's where the team trained. And my assignment to that was basically the management of looking after the teams and providing their communication and their per diem and everything like that, and that was my job because of the background, I guess. Anyway, there are just tremendous super athletes that went down to Mexico City, and I had a lot of good exercise, and two standouts were Al Orter and Jim Ryan. Orter, of course, was a great Olympic discus thrower, and Jim Ryan a mile. But anyway, had some great experiences with them, and they, in training, why my responsibilities was a lot of there just to be in charge of the men's track and field team. I was being in charge of media contacts with the athletes through mail, finances of the team, and an apartment location in the fifth floor of the Olympic Village team down in Mexico City. I disturbed weekly distributed finances to all the men's track and field team, and had a lot of fun joking with them, saying that they couldn't get their weekly allowance from me unless they signed my flag. And so all the track men's track and field team and the officials all signed my flag, and I of course have it here. And then they signed it, and that's something that really was tremendous.
Yes.
And a lot of experiences with, Al Orter was a tremendous guy. I mean, he was so the discus, and I knew he was super, you know, he was just great. I was sitting with his coach when, at first I knew Al was going in for the gold medal. And my job was with the team was to keep them informed on telegrams they got or any mail they got or any communication, and not to let the outsiders come in unless it was all lined up. And Al Orter, on the day he broke the record, why I went into him and took a whole stack full, in fact, a shoebox full of communications with him. And he said, "It won't be long." And I said, "Well, that's right, and I have a lot of work to do." And so kidding him. But anyway, when he finally got ready to compete, why, it started raining. And I was sitting next with his coach of the Olympics. And these athletes had to go underneath, and we were in a position where we were watching them. And just before he performed, why, he was walking back and forth and under the stadium, and the discus, and the rest of them were all sitting down. And the coach, Frank Potts, told me, he said, "Now that's the best thing that's ever happened to him, because he's concentrating and the others are complaining." Well, anyway, it turned out that, sure enough, if he didn't get out there on his first throw, was for 212 feet and 6 inches, and 5.5 ahead of the title record place in East Germany, I'm sorry. But anyway, it took 35 years later before that was ever broken. Mm. Same day was about 50 feet long jump by Bob Beeman, which his jump was 29.2½, and that was one that was just totally unbelievable. Mm. Nobody could believe it.
Yeah.
And fortunately that day I was sitting on the stadium right probably maybe 25 feet from him when they were doing it, and of course his first throw was the difference that broke everything. And so that was quite an excitement. And then there's Jim Ryan, who was a great miler from Kansas high schools, and I knew him that way. Everybody's hoping he'd be second, but the day he rang, I was on a bus that was taking the athletes from our facilities over to the stadium, and a fellow named Kikino from Kenya, he was on that bus, and we were running late because of traffic, and so he just got off and ran that last mile by his own. I thought, gee whiz, whoever did that. Well, anyway, it turns out that he's the one that won the gold medal, and 3 seconds more than Jim. Another exciting thing to me was Bill Toomey, who was the decathlon gold medalist. And Bill was quite an athlete, and he also had a lot of friends there and everything. And one of the things they had to always have to do is the athletes, after they competed, they had to come in and let them test their system on if they had any alcohol or anything. And of course, he came in, and his family and also his girlfriend were waiting for him, and he it was just tremendous. And he got in there and did it, and of course he broke the record right off, and it didn't take him long. The interesting thing about South Lake Tahoe was it just 24 hours in advance why we thought we couldn't get in down there because of storms, and also there were a lot of medical thing. Some of the accidents down there were going after some of the people coming in.
Hmm.
And Howard Cosell, one of the interesting things about it, Howard Cosell, of course, was a very prominent television announcer at that time. And there was some interest, of course, because Tommy Smith and John Carlos were the ones of the athletes that came and had black gloves on their hands and came out to get their awards. And Howard Cosell had apparently heard something might happen, and he came into my office because none of the athletes could be interviewed at all except through me, and it had to be a certain amount of time before. And he came in, and what did I say? No, I'm sorry that you can't talk to him because it's too close to their competition. And he said, well, I'll just go ahead and do it anyway. And I said, just a minute, please. So I got two Marine guards that were down there, and they came upstairs, and they escorted him to get out. And, of course, Tommy Smith and John Carlos broke the records in 200-meter dash. And but when they went out, I knew there was something going to happen, so I was able to go over and be in the stadium. And they're very close when they came out from a tunnel, and they both had the black gloves on their arms and went out. Well, that's, of course, what they showed in the black discrimination of the United States. It was a conversation at that time. And, of course, immediately there was a lot of communication as to what should be done about it. Well, they had a meeting in my office by the staff and everybody as to what should be done and about that. And their thought was, well, those two athletes had to be shipped back to the United States. And so I set it up because my communication was with the transportation for athletes. And the next day was when they were supposed to go. And I gave them the expense money that they were supposed to be getting, as all athletes did. And we had a driver in a special taxi to take them to the airport. And that day, and of course, they had to go on back. There are a lot of things that athletes got, and for example, in 68, this fellow named Larry Quested, Quested, He was a 200-meter athlete, and he was really going to be doing something great. Well, he had contacted. He was supposed to get some information from Puma and Adidas, and he came to my office before the day he competed that day, or that same day, and he said, "I'm going to just give something to you that I just got," and somebody had given him a box, and it had $100 bills in it, in one shoe, and that was a heck of a lot of money back then. So he had that, and so he said, "What can I do?" And I said, "Well, put the bills in an envelope, and you should give it to Peyton Jordan, who's their head coach." And that's what he did, and it was a very experience. Well, anyway, those are the key things, for example, that my job is kind of head management within the communication in the office, and wasn't the athlete coach, but it was just about trying to get them, you know, controlled. And so as a manager of the Olympic team, it was a tremendous honor for me, and one that I've never forgotten, as you can probably tell.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I've just talked way too much, but that's what I'd have to tell you.
Yeah, that was perfect. Thank you. Is it okay if I ask you a few questions?
Sure.
So what did you think personally about what happened with Tommy Smith and John Carlos? How did you feel about that?
Well, I felt concerned. I felt about it. That's why I got over in the stadium, and I wished I'd had an opportunity to talk to them and told them, you know, that this is something that I know that they believe that way, but it's not a way to do it, to go out to the crowd. And, of course, at that time, you know, there wasn't much TV around the world as we have now. But it was something that I felt concerned about, that they would do that. And when they came back down is when they asked me to have them come over to my office, and we talked about it. And I didn't, of course, I wasn't going to set any rules and regulations, but the head coach then came over to decide what we're going to do on it. And that's when the manager and assistant coaches all got together in my office as to what they should do. And that's, I guess, the best I can tell you.
Mm-hmm. Before the games started, about 10 days before the start of the games, there had been some student protests and violence in Mexico City. Did you remember hearing about that?
Oh, yes. That's why before we left out of Denver to fly in there, there was a lot of, we were all concerned about it. In fact, there was a lot of military and also the public guards. When we'd go from where we were staying to the tracks, why they ride along the streets all the time, and you know, one of those things, you just kind of felt edgy because there'd been going on a lot of it, I guess, down at that time. But it finally they had enough guards and everything that they didn't really have anything happen. But I think it would have been, if they hadn't got it prepared for it, a lot of things could happen.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of the security at the games and the security measures taken?
I was very pleased because them to have the streets, we walked from our facilities into the stadium. Well, it was over quite a ways, and they has protected. And you saw them, you know. You just knew that there wasn't going to be some things happen that had been kind of mentioned that could happen. So they were very good. They protected us, and it couldn't have been any better. But I think that it was something that they were really concerned about.
Mm.
Something had happened before.
What were your impressions of Mexico City and the people there?
I loved it. I mean, I always heard about Mexico City, you know, and we got to get in a taxi and go downtown and see it. I really was impressed with the way they took charge of something that could have been terribly, but it was good. And I've always had good feelings about Mexico City and what they did to make the Olympics, at least in my opinion, great.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did you stay? Did you stay in the Olympic Village, or did you stay elsewhere at night?
I stayed at our office there, and in the building was not far from the on the court on the you know right in the area.
Okay.
Mine was fifth story, and that's when a lot of the coaches and stuff like that stayed there in sports, and so we were protected. But you didn't feel on the edge. You just knew that this could have been something, but there were so many military people and also policemen that you thought, well, heck, if it's going to happen, what's going to happen? But you kind of, lets you act more relaxed.
Yeah. Did you participate in the opening ceremony?
We didn't walk on the track. Wait just a minute. Yes, I did too, because I was also with the Olympics in 84 and 88, and going in. We were walking with the team from the United States track and field team, and we got to walk around there on that. And that, of course, is so exciting. I just about fainted.
Do you remember the gender verification tests that were done with the women athletes in 68?
No, I really wasn't. The only time that we saw them was in Denver before we left. But that's all. And also some training. But we didn't. We were not, interacted together at all.
Okay. What about any interactions with athletes from the Soviet bloc?
I don't know. I don't have any memory of anything. The athletes weren't, fighting as far as I knew. Of course, we were thinking about more things, more other things. We were trying to take care of. But so I if there's anything. Not quite so good. Why? I don't know much about it.
Mm-hmm. What about? Did you get to meet other managers from other nations?
Oh yeah. We'd meet. In the stadium or in the building, and around. And oh yes, we had meetings and real good relationship.
Does anything stick out in your mind of anybody that you might have met from another country? Any.
No, not that I can remember at all. Mm-hmm. Of course, and sometimes other Olympics that I was part of, they had little things. You always had something like that happen.
Yeah.
And I don't see anything there that at least it's not part of my memory, so it must have been bad.
Okay. What about the drug testing that was performed in 68? Can you tell me a little bit about the drug testing program in 1968?
The what program?
The drug testing program in 1968.
You have to explain that to me.
So 1968 was one of the first years that they implemented kind of a standardized drug testing program where they tested the athletes' urine after events, tested some of the athletes' urine after some events.
I don't have any memory of that, so it must have been worked out. My job was maybe I was so busy doing what I was doing that I don't have any memory of that.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure there's other people that can answer that question.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about the media and about Howard Cosell. So was that part of your job, was to help manage the media contacts and interviews?
They had to all, media had to all go through my office in order to get to talk to the athletes.
Okay.
So I was not aware, but I was one of those things that we were trying to be sure that everything is taken care of right. So, but for them to come in our building and have any personal invitations and so forth with athletes, they had to come through me. And then if it'd be all right, if the athletes weren't competing within 24 hours, it would be all right to set it up, and I'd communicate with the athletes, and they'd get together. We didn't have any problems on that part of it, except we did kind of cut her off the end. Just we heard there be some problems, with the Black Fist and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What about the closing ceremony? Did you get to witness the closing ceremony?
Oh, yeah. I was there, and I was about I was so excited about having been a part of that. And one interesting thing about that, it was back then I was head of my state high school association, and my secretary had just gotten some new equipment that I could call in from someplace and then record things to her, or she could ask questions. And so I called her every day to get keep things going, you know, what might happen or going to happen, so it just for my records. And so a lot of things that I've shared with you is something that the only reason I got this is because she's a very interesting person. She's 98 years old right now, and we talked about her typing out what I called in from Mexico City back then. So I had opportunities to communicate with my secretary, and everything I'm talking to you about is something that every day I would dictate to her.
Oh, that's really great that you were able to do that.
Yes, it was. It was very, very interesting, and I was so excited, you know, that we had communication, we could do that.
Yeah. So when you got back to the States after the Olympic Games, what was your reception and homecoming like, and how did your friends and family feel about you having had such a prestigious assignment, you know, being part of the Olympic team?
Well, they were very interested in it. And of course, my parents my dad had been involved in athletics, and so I had opportunity to share everything with them, you know, and talk to them. And I here in Topeka, Kansas, at that time, gave several talks about what I've shared with you, just a little bit here and there, not near the detail years. But then I was asked to talk to athletic banquets during the year about what it's like to be involved as the job I had. And they knew I wasn't the athlete, but they knew that I was around them all, and I shared with you some information that I did.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about what your opinions or feelings are about what amateurism and what it meant to be an amateur was like in 1968 versus amateurism today?
Well, I don't know a lot about today, but I know that it's something that was just starting. I shouldn't say starting, but I was aware of, like, for example, that the fellow came to my office and showed me what $100 bill in it. That some of that was just getting started, where the manufacturers and others involved were passing on this to athletes. I don't know how much it was before that, but I know that was one of the things that started to kind of make everybody in the administrative area trying to keep on top of something. And that's my attitude.
Mm-hmm. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Oh, boy. It's been so long since then. I don't know. All I know is that first my involvement with the Olympics went from 68. I was on the United States Olympic Board and on the office several years after that. But what I really interested in basketball, naturally, that was my sport. And when Bob Knight was our coach at Los Angeles, and on in until 1992, when I retired, I was just basically on the boards and stuff like this. But it was a part of my life. I mean, you know, I just so damn lucky, and somebody coming out of a little town of 400, and but that's I have to say it's been a very important part of my life, and I carefully follow, you know, and follow into it. I retired in 1992, so, you know, I've had a lot of time, but I still just lucky. I'm just a lucky part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
85 right now, and very healthy for 85, and I look back at what you talked about and ask about, why kind of gave me a little excitement.
Yeah, definitely. You've had a wonderful career. Bryce, what do you think is the legacy of the 1968 Olympic team?
I can't give you a good answer on it, except I think it was one that, from what I've understood, going back to 64, and those years, starting with 68, it was something that really started really rolling. I think part of it could have been because of communication, the television and so forth, you know, and the war, and everybody had an opportunity to see what's going on rather than just hearing it or reading it in the paper. And I think that was kind of a good start. And I noticed going from there to 72 and right on up, but with some that I've been involved in, why it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like being involved in the Olympic movement has had a big impact on your life.
Oh, no question about it. I should. If I told you otherwise, I'd be lying. No. So I'm very fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you'd like to tell me about?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't, you know, my life, I'm so fortunate in athletics. I was so involved. And I never get... You'd never hang up because I'd be talking forever. But I just enjoyed very much the way you approached it and gave me a little chance to kind of go back because, as you know, all I've told you today isn't something that comes out of my mind without looking it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's understandable. It was 44 years ago.
Yeah. And give me your name and so forth.
My name is Desiree Hargis, and I work for the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. Yeah, it's at the University of Texas in Austin.
Oh, yeah. My brother was a mathematics professor down there for many, many years.
Oh.
That's named John Durbin.
John Durbin.
And so I've always followed the University of Texas.
Yeah. And that place where I work is also a designated Olympic study center. So the International Olympic Committee has designated that center where I work at the university an Olympic study center. So as part of that, we're doing this project to keep the legacy of the 1968 team alive and preserved.
Oh, that's great. You started one, right? You know, as I reflected back, I just think that a lot of things happened about 68 that, you know, was the starting point that made things get better and better. And I watched the Olympics, so they always up and downs, but I'm very, very proud to be just a part of it.
And you should be, definitely. And we're proud that you were part of it.
I can brag about it, but I shouldn't. Nobody here and just say, shut up, Dad. Okay.
Well, Bryce, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and your memories. We really appreciate it.
Okay. I appreciate very much your approach and how kind you are.